So again, not about trust. It's about this cycle of trust and respect, or what I sometimes actually call trust, risk, respect, because you have to trust the team to take the risk. You have to feel that the risk was met with respect. And if you don't, then trust diminishes and the cycle starts going backwards instead of forwards, right? It's either a virtuous cycle or a vicious one. You choose, and you choose actually based on respect.
Welcome to the Building Excellence Podcast. I'm your host, Bailey Miles. The Building Excellence Podcast is all about sharing inspiring stories from some of the most successful athletes, coaches, business minds, and thought leaders to help you build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. To learn more, visit baileymiles.com and be sure to rate, review, and follow us on all social media platforms. Now let's get to the show and start building excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy. Dr. David Berkus is one of the world's leading business experts. His forward-thinking ideas and best-selling books are helping leaders build their best team ever. He is the best-selling author of 5 books about business and leadership. His books have won multiple awards and have been translated into dozens of languages. Since 2017, David has been ranked multiple times as one of the world's top business thought leaders. His insights on leadership and teamwork have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, USA Today, Fast Company, The Financial Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, CNN, the BBC, NPR, and CBS This Morning. A former business school professor, he now works with leaders from organizations across all industries, including Pepsi, Fidelity, Adobe, and NASA. On the show, David shares his story of growing up, the power of story, leadership, common understanding, psychological safety, pro-social purpose, and his newest book, Best Team Ever, which is the surprising science of high-performing teams. David gives you a framework from hours and hours of research to help you build your best team ever. To find out more about David, his books, podcasts, speaking, and resources, check out davidberkus.com as well as the links in the show notes. Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome to the Building Excellence Show. Today I have a special guest, Dr. David Berkus. David, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, if you wouldn't mind, maybe give our listeners some context to you and what life was like growing up for you.
What life was like growing up. Oh, that's an interesting one, right? So, these days I'm an organizational psychologist by training. I was a B school professor for a long time. But even when I, since you said growing up, even when I was in high school and what have you, what I wanted to be was a writer, which is sort of what I am now. I spend most of my time writing and traveling around and speaking and consulting with organizations. So 17, 18 years old, went to undergrad for study English and creative writing. And when you're that young, you think that means novelist. You think that means you're going to write fiction, what have you. The idea that there was nonfiction out there that wasn't just textbooks hadn't occurred to me because I was an idiot 17-year-old, right? Huh. And but then as you're starting to study it, you're in this whole program, you're taking journalism classes alongside of it and reading science writing and all of this sort of stuff. I had kind of that new passion, which was to write about social science, predominantly inside organizations. I ended up saying these are the types of books that I wanted to write. Of course, I graduated with a totally useless degree in literary writing, writing fiction. But that still taught you the elements of storytelling and what have you that are huge inside my books now. So that meant I needed to learn a bit more. So I went into a master's degree for organizational psychology, married a medical student. We're still married, but we had study dates for the first 2 years of our marriage because she was in school, I was in school. And then I got finished with a master's and she was still in school. So I said, what the heck? Let's just do the doctoral program too. And then lots of different things led to one another. I ended up teaching in business school till basically until COVID, till 2020. Totally unintentional. Again, the goal was just to be writing about and sharing all of this stuff. The line I like to use sometimes is I'm trying to get good ideas out of the ivory tower and into the corner office. I guess now it's corner office, co-working space, or kitchen, wherever people are working these days. Yeah. But that's the goal.
Yeah. So even going back even to high school, middle school, were you someone who was naturally curious about different types of things and enjoyed the creative aspect of writing? Is that why maybe you had some inclination to want to do that?
Yeah. I mean, I liked, I guess I just had an appreciation for really captivating storytelling, right? I just had this sort of appreciation for the way somebody could use words to put all sorts of pictures into your mind. Especially truthfully, even so, here's what I think is interesting. When I look back on it and I think about what I do now, there were novels for sure, but then there was those sort of novels that blur the line. Like what part of this, I think, because I was just in that sort of 17-year-old male in the literary space. But you look up to people like a Jack Kerouac or what have you, who are exaggerating their relatively true story. And so that became even more fascinating. Like my favorite writer to read as a fan is, and I'm excusing like people in my subject matter who I'm fans of for different reasons, but it's like a Ben Mezrich, someone who can tell this amazing thriller story, but almost all of it's true. Right. So even I think when I was in high school, I had an appreciation for that kind of storytelling. Hey, this story is based in truth, or that most of this story happened, and yet it's the most kind of riveting tale, series of events you've ever heard that keeps you captivated and imaginative and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how did you wind up maybe teaching business? And like you touched on, you didn't really understand, you didn't even think about doing that, but then it kind of came upon you.
Yeah. So I was working in the pharmaceutical industry by day, in sales and marketing there, studying org psychology and going on study dates with my wife at night. And then a couple of different things happened. The Affordable Care Act passed in, you know, January, February, 2029, somewhere in there, or sorry, 2009, 2029 doesn't exist yet. And whatever you want, I take no position on like whether that was great or not or what have you. I just knew even then that that meant that the entire healthcare industry was going to change, in particular pharmaceuticals, in particular marketing and sales around pharmaceuticals had a lot of changes going for them. So I was kind of like, hey, I need to probably find a lifeboat before everybody else in order to make this work. And again, when that's your background and you've got a master's and half a doctorate in organizational psychology, the biggest, easiest option available to you is teaching. So I thought, oh, let's give it a shot. So I taught adjunct at a couple different universities. One of them turned into a full-time offer when one of the sort of older, probably should have retired sooner than he did, people surprised everyone within a retirement based on some health issues. And they needed me to fill in. So what was an adjunct full-time semester turned into a full-time offer and a tenure track position. So like I said, completely accidental. It was just sort of a response. I thought what I was going to do was climb the corporate ladder inside this company, use everything I was learning to be the best leader ever, and, you know, retire at 50 and write these leadership books based on my 30-year career in marketing and sales and pharmaceuticals and healthcare and all of that sort of stuff. And it turned out a little bit differently, but the end goal was still the same, right? The goal when I was 17 years old was to have my name on books that people found entertaining and useful. And hey, we got there. A little bit different route, but we got there.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting you talk about storytelling and creativity and being able to write, because what you've touched on in a lot of your books too, and this newest one too, is the power of being able to tell a compelling story, to have people buy in and to develop clarity towards something. But even going back into your story of starting in being a teacher, how has maybe teaching helped you have an understanding of maybe people, but also how it helps with the overall kind of perspective on business and organizations?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things there. First of all, if you can explain high-level, in-depth, well-researched psychological concepts to 19-year-olds, you pretty much explain it to anybody else. So from a pure kind of like, because what people want isn't necessarily the insight, they want relevance. Right. And so when you have to do the work of thinking, how can I make, okay, we're talking about self-determination theory today, which is that, you know, you might remember it as what Dan Pink wrote about in Drive, right? Autonomy and mastery, and actually self-determination theory says connectedness, not purpose, but there's some simplification there that Dan did, but we won't get into that. Okay. And I have to make these concepts relevant to, you know, a 19-year-old, or I taught some in the MBA program too. So a 27-year-old, right? Mm-hmm. And I have to make those that process that you go through of thinking through, how do I make this relevant? I still use that regularly. Who's my audience and how do I make this specific insight relevant? So that's been super helpful. I think the other thing that's funny, I'll just tell you this, is that most of what because I studied organizational behavior and taught those types of classes, teams and motivation classes, OB classes, what have you, a decent percentage of every class I did was team-based work. And it's really funny because students would complain about interpersonal problems on their team and then talk about how that's not like the real world because these slackers could just be fired in the real world. And I would laugh about it then and be like, you obviously haven't worked in the real world. I have, like, trust me. It's funny because it's still true, right? Like, now multiple times a year, I'm in with different companies running part of their senior leadership retreat, the top 17 senior leaders in the company. And like, the interpersonal dilemmas are the same. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was a really interesting laboratory to see same dilemmas, same problems, same friction, but from a, you know, a different audience, if you will. So those are probably the two biggest things I took out of it. Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a lot to be taken out of that. And like you said, being able to simplify things and make them actually relevant and applicable is key. And it's like a little laboratory, like you're talking about as well.
Yeah.
So kind of going into your career too, you took a step and you decided to do more writing and speaking now, and consulting is what you do today. How did that come about? And why did you decide to step into that and kind of step away from teaching?
Yeah. So, I mean, a couple different things happened at once, right? It's sort of, what's that line? Like, there's a line about going bankrupt. That's like, how did it happen? I'm like, well, slowly first, and then all of a sudden, right? And I even forget who the author is and what novel it's from, but it's sort of the same way. So I was always committed to writing. So teaching was great. And it also provided a lot of free time because it, you know, you have to be doing research and what have you. And so I was engaged in the research projects you are when you're a tenure track professor to try and get in all sorts of publications, but also engaged in building an audience. I started a podcast before they were cool. No offense. Yeah. They're cool now too, but you know, they're still cool. But like before it was cool, when there was a whole lot more work to do. We started a blog early, like 2009, 2010, got some audience traction. Actually, that became a really great way to do research because you're collecting like this audience of thousands of leadership practitioners who you can then feed a survey to and do some really cool research academically with. Mm-hmm. And that all led to my first book that came out in 2013. And then the book was out, and the marketing of the book leads to invitations to come in and speak, or could you work with our company on this or what have you? So started doing that. That picks up more and more and more. 2016, I released a book called Under New Management, which did a whole lot better than the first book, and really kind of got, because of where we were, because of who I was, and because where we were, work, society, et cetera, it kind of got branded as like a, here's how to deal with Gen Z book, which was not the intent. Like, the book was actually, here's what's changing, here's where the future of work is headed and what have you. But a lot of people picked it up for that reason. So I got more and got busier and busier. And by 2018, I was scaling down how many classes I was teaching in order to kind of juggle these various different commitments. And then the all of the sudden was when COVID hit. I was still teaching somewhat a few classes during COVID and flipped them to online, taught the following semester. But you know, if you know what happened, a lot of especially private universities got hit pretty hard. With declining enrollment, people not wanting to pay tons of money for online classes or hybrid classes or what have you. So they just deferred. And when it started to look like different universities were in a financial pinch, I just was like, I don't need this. I've got plenty of other opportunities otherwhere. So please don't like lay off somebody else and keep me because I have a big name or whatever, please. So we just walked away entirely. Whatever that would have been, fall 2020. Yeah. And the other thing that happened is that book about the future of work that included stuff about remote work led to doing a whole other book about focused fully on remote work instead of just a chapter or two that came out in January 2021. And so that side got so much busier too, that I probably would have had to step away anyway, but it just so happened to be, you know, kind of the right thing to do and the right timing. Everything sort of fell together. So slowly at first and then all at once.
Yep. And you talk about timing. It was good timing. So kind of going into what you're doing today, you have a new book coming out, or book that's out. It's called Best Team Ever. Talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book and why it matters.
Yeah, well, I think the big revelation for me that came out during the pandemic, post-pandemic, during hybrid work or return to office or whatever we want to label the current place we're in right now. The big revelation that I've had is that company culture is kind of bogus, right? That's not to say there's no such thing as company culture. That's not to say it's not worth thinking about company culture, but most people's experience of work, most people's feeling of whether or not they're engaged, whether or not they're enjoying their work, whether or not they're productive, right? And whether or not they're a high performer is influenced far more by the team that they're on than the company they're a part of. right? And this was true before the pandemic too, because we have these phrases like people don't quit bad companies, they quit bad bosses. That's true. They quit the bad team, the bad experience they're having individually, not that overall company. And I don't know that there's some great works out there. Five Dysfunctions of a Team is great. Daniel Coyle's The Culture Code is great. I think it's kind of incomplete, at least in unpacking the research. And so I felt like there needed to be, if team culture matters more than company culture right now, and I would argue for the foreseeable future, because I think it was true before the pandemic, but we're at a moment where I think we can finally deal with that. Mm-hmm. Then there needs to be that kind of manual on how do I, as an individual leader, maybe I'm just a middle manager inside the organization, or maybe I'm a small business owner. And so I don't have a 1,000 person organization. I just have the people that report to me and maybe two other leaders in the company. How do I build at the team level that culture that inspires high performance, that engages people? And so that was kind of the intent to do. So we took a lot of the different streams of research. There's about 40 plus years of great research from academics and researchers who are far more talented on the quantitative side and on the research methodology side than I am, outlining kind of these are the common elements of great teams. My goal was to pair a lot of that with that relevancy piece we were talking about before. Okay, so now that you understand this concept, do these things to build that. And so that's what we started working on it about a year ago now, and now here we are.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Well, in the book, you break it down into three sections, mm-hmm. each having a couple points that you touch on. The first one being common understanding. You talk about clarity and empathy. And I think I love the story you touched on about USA Curling. I think it was John Schuster. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't mind kind of dive into that and why that's applicable to that common understanding and clarity piece.
Yeah. I mean, really, John Schuster it's an example of this problem of teams and performance too, right? So John Schuster, I've been fascinated with John Schuster and what they call Team Reject for a while now. They were just up in 2022 in the Winter Olympics again. We'll talk about that in a bit. But they were the gold medalists in 2018. Their curling team won, USA Curling, Team USA won the gold medal at the Olympics. No one expected them to do that. And it's even crazier when you factor in that they had been essentially the four people who won the gold medal had been rejected by USA Curling earlier. So Schuster is no stranger to curling. If you're a stranger to curling, I'll let you know who he is. So he competed for the US Olympic team also in 2014 and also in 2010. And he choked tremendously both times. So he was one of the best curlers, and his team were the best team of curlers that the USA could put forth in the international competition. And then they did terrible in said international competition. And so after they choked in 2014, Team USA, or USA Curling, the governing body, decided okay, forget this. We're going to develop our own high performers. And essentially part of their plan was essentially to steal good athletes from other sports and try and convince them to join curling and what have you. And so they didn't invite Schuster. They didn't invite Matt Landsteiner or any of the other guys who were part of the team that choked to be a part of their developmental program. Mm-hmm. And that kind of lit a fire under them, right? And so what happened was they essentially dubbed this moniker Team Reject. They practiced on their own. They funded their own ways to competitions. And they actually earned, little by little, they earned the right through the Olympic trials to actually represent Team USA again in 2018. And nobody wanted to do it, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, if you think about this is a huge problem for USA Curling, right? What do you do? You have these people that are known rejects. No one's excited about sending them. And yet they're the best they could offer. And so they reluctantly did. Everybody was criticized, right? People were basically fans of curling, all 17 of them. I'm kidding. That's mean. That's a joke. But fans of curling were like, we shouldn't even send a team this year if we're going to send these embarrassing people. And you know, for starters, it looked like they were. It looked like they were going to do just as terribly. They barely made it out of the round robin tournament into a single elimination. But then as soon as they hit the single elimination, something clicked into place and they won every single game. Their final game against Team Sweden went so perfectly that there's sort of a mercy rule in curling. I won't explain it, but they essentially were playing so perfectly that before the rounds of shots were actually over, that Team Sweden conceded. They were like, mathematically, we can't win. So you win. Mm. And so this team that everybody had rejected became the best team in the world, right? The best team ever at that moment. Most of the members of the team too, I think this is really funny. Most of the members of the team were invited to also compete in 2022 at the Winter Olympics in 2022 that we just had. And while they didn't do as well, they came in, I think, fourth or fifth. This is still a respectable finish. They didn't do as well. John Schuster was actually selected by all of the Olympic athletes to lead the parade. So he, you know, they all come in during the opening ceremonies. He was the flag bearer for Team USA. This team that USA Curling didn't want, right? That basically rejected. And now all of these Olympic athletes are like, no, you're the perfect person to lead us right now, right? Which I think is just sort of stunning and shows two things, right? So one, that problem of talent. How do you find and attract the best talent? But to your point around common understanding and clarity and empathy, the thing that you build when you are rejected from a high performance program is not just the clarity that a normal sports training program and all that sort of, but you start to build empathy. Now you have this moniker of Team Reject. You have this group of four guys who have to support each other because there's nothing else there. So they get to know each other as a deeper team. It's not four talent. It's not that they took the four best people in curling in the United States and just said, you're a team now. They couldn't be that. They were already rejected from that. So they had to be something else, and they had to work together and something else and build an understanding of each other's strengths and weaknesses, how to give each other feedback, because you're now coaching each other. There's no coach to rely on and all of that sort of stuff. And so you build, again, not just clarity of task and here's the game of curling and how to win. They already knew that, man. They'd been in the Olympics three times. They already knew that. What they didn't know was how to connect with each other at a team level as well.
Absolutely. And that kind of brings you into the next point of empathy. Like how do people like that come together, have a commitment towards a common goal, and they have, they have skill obviously, or else they wouldn't be there. But at the same time, getting to know people at a different level, caring for each other, and then working towards something to be able to achieve a common outcome. Like how do you go about building empathy in your opinion, and based upon all the things that you've studied?
And what I mean when I say empathy here is a little bit different than, let's say, the full-on emotional meaning, right? Sure. So empathy and common practice is usually when, like, you know, when you can feel like Bill Clinton, I feel your pain, right? It's usually when you can kind of not just sympathize and understand that they're going through something, but you can kind of feel pain for them and what have you. That's sort of what we mean here, but not really. What I mean here is that we have a deep understanding of somebody else's work preferences. And let's use a work context here instead of USA Curling. Their work preferences, their personality differences, you know, the context they want to work in. This is probably another big lesson from the pandemic, is that, like, it's not a, do we work from home? Do we work in an office? Do we work hybrid? Whatever. Everybody has a different answer. Every individual person has a different set of preferences of where they want to do, what they want to work on, right? And so as a team, you have to understand all of those different differences. You have to understand the fact that, like, people are going to use simple, easy 50-year-old tools like email. They're going to use them. Different people use it differently. Some people write these long, drawn-out novels of emails, and other people write sounds good with their thumbs while they're driving, even though they know they shouldn't be, right? We use this tool differently. And you have to sort of understand that. Otherwise, you're going to get frustrated by a lot of things that aren't worth getting frustrated at. And you're also not going to know how to send the right message to other people, right? You have to know someone's communication preferences in order to put whatever is so important you need to tell it to them into the medium and the style that they're going to receive best. And you can certainly have a team without that level of empathy, but it's really hard to get a high performing one because you just don't know how to communicate all of the things you have to communicate on the clarity side, right? So clarity without that sense of empathy is almost brutal, right? Because everybody's constantly misunderstanding each other in an attempt to execute on what we've been assigned as a team.
Yeah. So how important is asking the right questions to understand how each person is tailored towards certain aspects of maybe email, a role, communication, conversation, setting. Workplace.
Yeah. No, I mean, huge, right? Because most of us are asking the wrong questions. Like, you know, when I talk about empathy, a lot of times people go, oh yeah, you know, we just had our whole team do StrengthsFinder, right? Or, oh, we just had our whole team do the Myers-Briggs. Like, okay, great. But, like, I don't need to know that you're an ENTJ. I need to know why your emails are so long, right? and I don't need to know that you're an activator or whatever. I need to know what's going on in your home life and why what the schedule that works best for you is to leave at 3:30 and then you're going to come back online and do 2 more hours of focused work from 7 to 9 after your kids are, like, fed and showered and ready for bed and what have you. And I need to adjust our team's work schedule in such a way where that 7 to 9 is deep focused work because no one else is going to want to be on the team at 7 to 9. Like, that's what I need to know. And so in order to to do that, I can't just ask you, you know, are you an introvert or an extrovert? Those are great to know, but that doesn't, that's not as deep as we need to go here. And so the method that I use for a lot of teams to do this, by the way, is I call it either a team charter or a ways of working document or something like that. And we go question by question. It's not one big question. It's lots of little questions of usually where there's been conflict or misunderstanding on the team is how you tell, but it's little questions. It can be, hey, what do we agree as a team would be a reasonable amount of time to respond to each other's emails? 24 hours, 12 hours? Do we need to respond by end of day? Let's have a conversation about that. How long should our emails be? Or do we need to, as a team, would we rather have one subject per email and more communication in our inbox? Or would we rather, like, what do we want to do? There's no right answer. While we're talking about that, let's ask bigger questions. What tools do we want to use beyond email? Do we want to use a project management software? Do we want to use Slack? Do we want to use Voxer? If we're, you know, especially if you're not in the knowledge work world, a lot of times those like walkie-talkie apps work better, right? So what tools do we want to use? What's a reason to call an all hands meeting versus have an asynchronous discussion, right? All of these are questions that usually we don't ever have, conversations we never have with a team. But because we never have them, we have all these taken for granted assumptions about how people should be acting, how they should be working or communicating what they're working on. And then people violate our taken for granted assumption. They act against what we assumed they should act. How dare they, right? I never told you I expect this from you, but you underperformed my expectations that I never told you about. How dare you, right? It's stupid. But we do it all the time. And so it's less about, you know, there's not one big question, but it's lots of those little questions about stuff that we'd normally take for granted. We can't afford to. Let's get it out in the open and have that conversation.
Yeah. And I think you touched on a really good word, not assume. Don't assume things.
Yeah.
When you put it out there, you ask the right questions, you get it out in the open, people understand, they have a sense of clarity, going back to the first word you talked about, of understanding roles. I know that's something you touched on as well, is understanding your roles and having clarity towards that. But also, when I was reading your book, I was writing down next to the margin, having collaborative clarity. So understanding as a team, being able to know what roles each person has, kind of going back to what you just talked about, empathy, like understanding how people tick, but at the same time, understanding their role in the clarity of the context of the greater mission.
Yeah, for a while I called it, I broke down common understanding as clarity of tasks and clarity of people. But ultimately I settled on that word empathy, mostly because I thought it'd get confusing to have clarity twice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's important to understand the two distinctive ways of looking at and asking the right questions. And even going into maybe the second part, there's another aspect of it where it's psychological safety. And you touched on two points there, trust and respect. And maybe talk a little bit about how you can develop trust and respect in an environment where people feel safe to say what they really feel and what they mean, because that's something that's really challenging. I know you brought up a great topic or a great story with Alan Mulally of Ford, which I'd love for you to talk about that, because that's powerful in being able to have that environment where you can feel comfortable and safe to go and do that.
Yeah. Alan Mulally, CEO of like the century, in my opinion, in my humble, worthless opinion. But, you know, talking about trust on a team is not new. We've been talking about that forever. I think what a lot of people don't get is that what they're describing they want on a team and what the research backs up is not actually trust. It's what we would call psychological safety, which is feeling that the group is safe for interpersonal risk-taking. It's not safe spaces. It's not you're never going to hear anything you disagree with or that challenges you, what have you. It's when people trust each other enough to take a risk and say what they really think, which might disagree with you and hurt your feelings, or speak up with this crazy idea, right? That they might get judged for, but they trust the group to do that. Or even just to admit a failure and then let the team dissect all of that, right? And so what we're really talking about here isn't just trust, but it's this cycle of trusting acts being met with respect, right? It's not enough to say, oh, I feel like I can speak my mind. If I don't feel heard after I speak my mind, I won't feel like I can speak my mind much longer, right? So again, not about trust, it's about this cycle of trust and respect, or what I sometimes actually call trust risk respect, because you have to trust the team to take the risk. You have to feel that the risk was met with respect. And if you don't, then trust diminishes and the cycle starts going backwards instead of forwards, right? It's either a virtuous cycle or a vicious one. You choose, and you choose actually based on respect. And so, you know, you mentioned this Alan Mulally story. This is exactly what was the real turnaround that had to happen at Ford from 2006 to about 2017, 18. I'm blanking on exactly when he resigned, but Alan was in charge of turning around Ford Motor Company. Even before, like most of us remember 2008, the Great Recession, how that hit the automakers and what have you. And what people forget is it didn't actually hit Ford as badly as General Motors and as Chrysler, because they had started working on their problem in 2006. They saw the writing on the wall in 2006. They hired Alan. And one of the things he diagnosed was the culture of not only the senior leadership team, but all the teams throughout the organization was toxic. He's so nice. I've interviewed him so many times now. He doesn't like to use the word toxic. He actually, I sent him this chapter and he struck it from the, like he drew a red X through that word. But I really feel like that's the best word. You had this intra-competitive culture. Everybody saw their competition as people they were working with because they were competition for the next promotion, not people, not other companies. If you could survive, like it was one of the few industries that even in the 2000s, people saw themselves as lifers committed to Ford, and therefore they're going to be here for 30 years. So I'm either going to be stuck in this role or I'm going to have to climb over other people to get to the next thing. And what that creates is an environment where no one's willing to admit failures. Everyone's looking for an opportunity. If you show a kink in their armor, they're going to stab you in that, right?
Yeah.
So everybody's looking for that. And Alan knows that needs to turn around, right? That we need to call the situation what it is. 2006, their projections, what they sent to investors, the real communication they sent to shareholders of Ford was, we plan to lose $17 billion this year. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Right. And Alan was committed to calling things the way they were and being open and honest about that. He was even open and honest about where they were kind of in mindshare. His first day as CEO, a reporter asked him, hey, what kind of car do you drive, Mr. Mulally? And he said, a Lexus. Uh-huh. Not only did he say a Lexus, he said, I drive a Lexus. It's the finest car on the market. That's his exact quote. Right. I mean, they followed up afterwards with, that's why I'm excited about Ford. I think we can overtake them. We have the potential to become the finest. But what he's saying through the lines is, I'm going to be honest about where we are. We're not there. Right. And he asked his leadership team to commit to the same transparency. By the way, they all pretty much drove Ford in cars too. They just would never admit it. And one of the things they did was what he called the sort of business plan review. Every Thursday morning, 7 a.m., Thunderbird Conference Room in Dearborn, Michigan, the senior leadership team got together and they reviewed about 320 different metrics of success for Ford as an organization. Everybody was assigned a certain number. You know, here's how we're judging your department and what have you. And you're going to come in and every Thursday morning, the whole senior leadership team is going to get an update on where everybody else is. And Alan, to make it easy, because 320 is a lot of numbers. That's a lot of slides.
Yeah.
Alan asked the leaders, hey, color code your slides. Green means everything's a go. Everything's great. We're on plan. Yellow means we're getting off plan. We're running into some problems. But we know how to handle it. So we're just keeping you in the loop on things. And red would mean we're off plan and we have no idea how to get back. We have a problem we can't solve. Right. Now think about the crazy toxic culture I just described. And you can imagine what happened next, which is that the first time that team got together, 320 green slides.
Yeah.
For a company that's going to lose $17 billion, 320 green slides. Alan was like dumbfounded. Like, you're telling me there's nothing wrong. Or you're telling me you're not the problem, at least. Uh-huh. This went on, by the way, for 8 weeks. Week two, 320 green slides. Alan going, come on, somebody's got to admit something. Week three, 320 green slides. Alan started calling them like gems. Like, they'd come to the meeting and be like, who can show me a yellow or a red gem? Right? Because gems are where we find value, because we can fix a problem and create some value. Who can find a gem? It wasn't until week nine that one executive, Mark Fields, had a problem essentially, and he sort of backed into a corner on it, right? Essentially, part of his scope of responsibility was the launch of the Ford Edge. The Ford Edge was being produced in Oakville, Ontario, and the facility there was having a production issue that was fixable, but it had to be fixed by hand. So we're making cars at a really fast rate, fixing them at a slower rate. We've got a bottleneck. We've got a backlog of cars. And there's a moment where they realize we are not going to be able to meet our commitment to launch this car on this date. We're going to have to push the launch back. So no choice there but to tell the leadership team, hey, here's what's going to happen. Interestingly enough, Mark's team, the people underneath Mark, tried to convince him to make the slide green, right? Oh, yeah, no, it's still fine because it's green because because we know how to fix it. It's just going to take time. And Mark pushed back and was like, I don't know. It sounds like this is one of those red slides that Alan's always talking about. Maybe we should make it red. So in week 9, Mark makes it red. 319 green slides, one red slide. Dead silence, right? Mark's on the edge launch. We're red. We're going to have to push the launch back. No one else says anything. All of them are just staring at Mark, staring back at Alan, right? How's he going to respond? Staring back, taking a good long look at Mark. Because Alan actually told me one time, he goes, I thought people were waiting for me to like push a button under the table and have these two big security guards come escort Mark out, yeah. Right? But that's not what Alan did. Instead, Alan started clapping. Hey, Mark, thank you. This is great visibility. Okay, you know what? Let's focus entirely on this. Rest of this meeting's canceled. What can we do for Mark? And they started to develop a plan. And, you know, it took time. It's not like they solved the problem overnight. That'd be a better story, but it's not the truth. But it took some time. So they developed a plan. They all dismissed. Everybody said goodbye to Mark because, again, they all thought, like, they saw the act of respect that Alan exhibited, but there's a long history of not meeting that. So I think a lot of people left that meeting still thinking that Mark was done, right? When this is all over, Mark will be out and somebody else will be implementing our plan. It wasn't until week 10 where there were also 319 green slides because everybody thought Mark was going to be fired. It wasn't until week 10 when the rest of the executives get to the Thunderbird conference room and they find out that Mark is not resigned. He hasn't been fired. He's there. In fact, he was there early. He is sitting next to Alan Mulally. He's at Alan Mulally's right-hand side at the table. Like, did Mark just get promoted? What the heck just happened, right? And Alan Mulally later told me that was actually the moment, right? Seeing that Mark had been almost rewarded for his transparency was the moment people took everything seriously. They realized that they could, that it was safe to take the risks of admitting failures and admitting problems. And so by week 11, you actually had some color in the slide deck. You actually had people taking that risk, having the real report on where they were as an organization. And little by little, they were able to make a plan and turn it around. So much so, the financial crisis hit in 2008. The Ford was offered government bailout money, just like General Motors and Chrysler, and they didn't take it. They said, we're fine. We have our problems, but we're working on them. And we've been working on them for 2 years now, and there's no reason to take this bailout. Right. And when Alan resigned, he served for about 12 years at Ford. And when he resigned, he gave the board his resignation. He showed them the financial statements. The financial statements showed a $6.6 billion profit. Right. So he gave them a $6.6 billion and he gave them a recommendation on who should succeed him as CEO. You can pick whoever you want, but my recommendation is Mark Fields. And I think it's interesting because Mark did become CEO. He didn't serve for very long. And Ford, if you know where we are now in 2023, Ford is not doing as well as they were when Alan left. And that sort of goes to that idea. Trust, risk, respect is a virtuous or a vicious cycle. When Alan built an amazing team that helped turn around Ford, but when the people there started to leave and the culture started to change, a lot of it reverted back to where it was. And what used to be a high-performing senior leadership team is not as much anymore. And that just shows you sort of how fickle this is, how much work it takes to not just build trust once, but to respect every risk that happens, because you realize if you don't, that trust starts to diminish.
Mm-hmm. I love that you touched on the cycle and even to your aspect of how you have to be able to say those things and be true to what you're saying, but also because you're doing that, you're gaining respect, there's trust that's established. And one thing, as you're talking about that story, because it's a powerful story, is there ways that if someone's listening right now and they lead a small team or a big team, could you go in and try to get with a leader that's on, let's just say you're Alan Mulally, you're in a room, you're meeting with different leaders, and there's a guy that is respected by a lot of the team there. Is there a good way of maybe going to that person and saying, hey, I would love for you to just be honest instead of having to wait for a long time?
Yeah.
Because it's important that you give people time. But sometimes I just wonder, going to someone who's respected and then being able to have them be transparent and authentic. And then all of a sudden, wow, the leadership team sees that and they're able to develop that understanding. I don't know. I'm just curious.
Can you seed your own Mark Fields moment if you were? The thing I would say first is that if you're a leader, you go first, actually. Why don't you just get vulnerable? Why don't, and not, not deal breaking vulnerability here. You don't need to have like a crying session with your team and talk about how your parents never loved you, right? Well, that's not what I mean, but you can admit your own flaws. You can admit your own weaknesses. And that signals to the team that, hey, it's okay to talk about these things. It's okay to talk about the fact that the reason I write such short emails is that I'm terrible at grammar and spelling, and I would much rather talk it all out.
Sure.
You know, that's that level of self-disclosure. You could do that right away. And we know this from the research literature, right? That when I'm vulnerable in front of you, when I take that risk in front of you, so long as you're not embedded in a toxic culture where you've learned bad habits of how to respond to that, the most human response is you actually do trust me a bit more because you realize in that moment, I'm trusting you. Mm-hmm. And so you respond in kind. And we can see this. We've done this in the lab so many times that we can actually see it in like the hormones, the chemicals floating around in your brain. Trust is usually felt when you describe trust. It's because you have high levels of oxytocin in your brain, and moments of vulnerability actually stimulate the production of oxytocin in yours. If I'm vulnerable with you, you get more oxytocin, right? And so that's what I would say first. Now there's a couple of situations where you may not want to do that, right? If you're a new leader, it may actually be a good idea to stage that level, take somebody who's well-respected and say, look, man, what I really need is for you to be super honest, right? I'm trying to think of an in-person example, but the only one I can actually really think about in the moment is, I don't know if you watched any of the seasons of Ted Lasso, the show about soccer and what have you, and the football coach go to soccer. But one of the first things he does there, right, is he does a little stupid little sort of suggestion box, but he targets Roy Kent because he's the captain. And Roy Kent's biggest complaint is about the shower. And what does he do? He fixes the shower. Why? Because he knows that Roy's going to see that, and Roy's going to have to say thank you in front of the rest of the team. And then the team's going to have to trust him, right? So you can do that.
Yeah.
Most of the time, I would recommend going first, especially if you've been the one leading the team and not paying attention to the cycle. Mm-hmm. I would go first. And the other thing I would do is I get really serious about watching your responses. Are you actually actively listening? Even when it's hard, even when people are disagreeing with you and you just want to tell them like, that's a stupid idea, right? Yeah. You still have to help them feel heard. And so you have to change the dynamic. You have to ask them a lot of follow-up questions, help them feel heard. Maybe you can guide them to realizing their idea is stupid. Because let's be honest, some people have stupid ideas. Doesn't matter. What they need to feel is that you gave them space, that you listened to them, that you valued their contribution, even if you disagreed with it. Mm-hmm. And then, right, then they'll feel respected. And so they'll be more likely to trust you in the future with another idea, which, by the way, might be a way better one and might be the one you actually wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Listening and then leading from the top down, being authentic to who you are as a person, I think is key. So I think that's a great perspective. And real quickly, as we wind down, the final point that I want to make with you is you had the third topic, pro-social purpose. And you talked about meaning and impact. And I love how you talked about earlier, you always wanted to write and you love the creative side of being able to articulate stories in a different way. But KPMG, you brought up a topic where they were able to bring out the 10,000 stories initiative that really changed the game for them. If you wouldn't mind kind of talk about why those things are important and maybe talk about that story as well.
Yeah. So this was an initiative led by Bruce Pfau at KPMG. KPMG is an accounting firm, you know, tax accounting, auditing. A lot of what they do is auditing, which is, that job's got to be terrible. No offense if you listen to this show and you're an auditor, but like, if you think about the job, you went through school, you did all of the work to get study accounting, get a CPA, which is extra classwork, by the way, because you have to have 150 credit hours to sit for the CPA exam, which is basically a bachelor's and half a master's, maybe a full master's, depending on where you went. And then your job is not to work at KPMG's offices. Your job is to sit in the offices of some other company and audit all of their books and audit all that and point out any discrepancies and then go ask questions from people who don't want to answer your questions because your questions mean you, like the fact that you have a question means they screwed up. So they don't want to answer your questions, right? It's got to be it's got to be an awful job, honestly. And so it's no surprise that like all of the big four accounting firms kind of struggle with retention and engagement. And that's kind of okay because they all operate on a partner model. So it's an up or out model anyway. But Bruce Pfau was like, we got to turn this around. And one of the things that he noticed in the annual engagement survey he was looking at to try and figure out how to turn this stuff around was very, very few people answering in the affirmative to, I feel that the work that I do makes an impact, that it's more than just a job. You know, that's crazy, right? And so what they did a twofold kind of process to change this. The first was about telling stories from the past. It was called the We Shape History. And the idea was if people asked, what do you do at KPMG? You would answer, we shape history, which is kind of lame and not really you, but whatever, it worked. They told really cool stories about being involved in World War II through the Lend-Lease Act, which was how the US first got involved in World War II. Or about how KPMG certified the election of Nelson Mandela in 1992, or about how KPMG was involved in the recovery efforts from 9/11 and from the terrorist attacks and all the logistics of insurance contracts and recovery funds and all that sort of stuff. Cool stories. If you weren't, and they move the needle a little bit, but if you weren't working on those projects, right, you don't have a personal connection to that. So then they flipped it. And this was what I think is really genius. They said, you've heard all of these stories in the past. Tell us how you're making history right now. Tell us how you're making an impact right now. And so that was what they called the 10,000 Stories Challenge. They put out a call to the 30,000 something employees to tell them that story. What's your own personal answer to that question? What do you do at KPMG? I think it was really cool that We Shape History campaign actually made like posters and videos and what have you. And they made an app where you could kind of fill in your own answer and design your own version of these posters. So you're seeing all of this, for lack of a better term, corporate propaganda. And now they're the 10,000 Stories Challenge. And they're like, no, you can personalize it. You can make your own, right? And hang it in wherever you are. They wanted 10,000 stories. They got 42,000 stories within 6 months. 42,000 different answers to that question, you know, what do you do at KPMG? Or what I like to think of as sort of who is served by the work that you do. And by the way, as a business school professor, I both love this and it makes perfect sense. I love it because 30,000 employees generated 42,000 stories, which means some people went for extra credit.
Yeah.
It also makes perfect sense because it's a bunch of accounting majors, and accounting majors always went for extra credit, right? That's okay. That was consistent in my entire time there, right? Mm. So, but more specifically, I think what's telling is there were some inconsistencies on how seriously different teams took it. So the next year, when they were doing the employee engagement survey, they snuck a question in there. They asked, how well did your manager communicate purpose? In other words, on the team that you're on, did you guys take this challenge seriously or not? Were you involved in it? How many answers did you submit? How much of a conversation did you have? And when you look at that data, the difference between the teams that talked about purpose often and the teams that didn't, the ones that took 10,000 stories seriously and the ones that didn't, it's crazy, right? My favorite, there's a doubling of the number of people that respond, I feel that the work that I do makes an impact. It's not just a job. But my favorite is on the teams that communicate purpose regularly, that took this story's challenge seriously, only about 25% of them responded, 75% of them responded affirmatively to the statement, I rarely think about looking for a new job. That gets flipped. In the teams that didn't take it seriously, only 25% of people affirmed that, which means 75% of people on the teams that don't talk about purpose regularly often think about looking for a new job, right? That's what that actually means. That's why I had to phrase it so carefully. It's a delicate way of figuring out that on the teams that don't have a sense of purpose, 75% of people are looking for a way out, are looking for something else to do, right? And that's why pro-social purpose is such a massive part of making a high-performing team, is it keeps people on the team, right? If you're always looking for a way out because you think that the work you're being asked to do is boring and meaningless, then what's the point of doing any of the other work we talked about? If you're going to get a job in a different team 2 months from now, you're not going to build common understanding. You're not going to show vulnerability, right? Mm-hmm. You're not going to do any of those other activities. Beyond that, there's a myriad of research about how purpose, and specifically a pro-social, meaning the desire to promote or protect the well-being of other people, how that's a huge motivator, how that bonds teams together, what have you. But at its simplest level, what's the point of staying on the team if it doesn't meet that basic fundamental need to do work that matters?
Absolutely. And how would you say, what are the best ways to go about helping your team uncover what that looks like for each group or team that they're involved in? Like, how do you uncover the meaning and the impact that you're actually making, and maybe asking certain questions or doing certain things that enable you to have that understanding?
Yeah. So some teams get it right off the bat. Usually customer facing teams, they know very well who served. It's the customer. Mm-hmm. Where you really struggle with this is And nonprofit organizations, right? The stakeholder and what have you. Sure. Where you really struggle with it is in larger organizations where you have several roles that are actually removed from interacting with the end who, the end person that benefits from that organization's existence. And we use a variety of different terms for this. We might call it support staff or back office or all of these terms that imply, truthfully, I hate because they imply that the work that those teams do is less important, right? Because it's in the back. And that's stupid. But the idea is that their work is serving someone inside the organization who's serving someone outside the organization. That's still fine. That's still an act of service. So you still have to identify that team-wide who. You may not get it right away. Sometimes you will. If I just talk about, can you answer that question, who is served by the work that we do? That discussion often leads to some teams realizing it. The other thing I like to do if we're really struggling is I'll do what I call the It's a Wonderful Life test with teams. So you remember this movie, It's a Wonderful Life? It was it's a Christmas classic now, even though it wasn't when it came out. Actually, fun story, it was a total flop at the box office and nobody cared about it until it entered the public domain. And then TV stations used to show it all the time because they didn't have to pay anyone to show it on the TV station. Okay. And then it became a Christmas classic. But anyway, the premise of that movie, George Bailey feels like his life has no meaning, feels like he doesn't want to go on, goes to commit suicide, and an angel named Clarence, which, by the way, is the worst name for an angel ever, right? Gabriel, Michael, Clarence. Doesn't make any sense, but whatever. Shows him what the world would be like if he didn't exist. Takes him around his community and shows him the impact of his life by showing him what the absence of his impact would be. And so that's what we do in the It's a Wonderful Life types of teams. Hey, let's not get morbid. We're not going to jump off a bridge, but like if all of us just sort of like disappeared tomorrow, if we all didn't show up to work for the same week, what would happen? Right? What departments would be affected? How would that affect the end? Just what would be those downstream effects? And usually then you flip it in the inverse of that, right? The impact your absence would make is a great way of figuring out the positive impact your presence makes. And now you know your who, so you know how to pay attention to those people and the stories that are going to come out of your continued good work serving them. And those stories are going to help you serve them even better because they're going to motivate that team together, et cetera.
Absolutely. And those are great perspectives that help you understand what that looks like and how to go about that and being a leader, but also being on a team and helping each other understand what that looks like. So real quickly, you know, David, you wrote this book, Best Team Ever. It's out. If people wanted to learn more about you and some of the tools and the things you have for great teams, or if people wanted to bring you in to speak, what's the best way to go about doing that?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to learn more about the book, awesome. The show notes for this podcast are great. Bailey does a great job putting all of that together. You're going to want to check it all out. You're in the podcast player anyway, so you might as well like swipe over or double tap or whatever it is. While you're there, by the way, leave a review of the show while you're there. You could talk about how awesome this episode is or just how awesome the show is. It doesn't matter, but like he's not going to ask you for that. I'll do it for you. And then you'll also find the links to where I am and what have you. If you can't do any of that because you're driving, just remember when you get to wherever you're going, plug in David Burkus into Google, B-U-R-K-U-S. There's not a lot of David Burkuses out there. It's a really weird last name. So it should be pretty easy to find me on whatever social you want to find. And I hope you do. And I hope you reach out with any questions you have, et cetera. Work is teamwork. That's not going to change. And so this is a conversation that's going to be going on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you for coming on the show, for sharing about your book, but also about the work that you do and the impact that you're making to help better teams be the best teams that they can be. So thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Building Excellence Podcast. If you found value today, we would really appreciate it if you shared the show and left a rating and review. Also, be sure to follow us on all podcasts and social platforms, as well as YouTube, where you can watch full video episodes. To learn more about the podcast or any coaching or speaking, check out baileymiles.com. Thanks again, and now go work to build excellence in your life, leadership, and legacy.